Coming up on another Badaptation episode of That Was a Show. Ferris Bueller was a show. The iconic John Hughes classic film about high school rebellion from 1986 was reimagined as a sitcom in 1990. Matthew Broderick was replaced by Charlie Schlatter, who, much like the Ferris of the film, often looks into the camera to address the audience. Only this Ferris is also explicitly aware of the existence of the film, for which he has an apparent disdain. This show also features Jennifer Aniston in her second time at bat. Join Bryn, Aaron, Barry, and special guest Simone Smith, who chose this show.
Hey, don't put this all on me.
I think we just broke the fourth wall. So, I guess, join us as we cut class and go on an adventure to see why this one got expelled. Cold open. We grew up during peak sitcom, Seinfeld, Friends, The Fresh Prince, but those shows were diamonds in the rough. This podcast is not about those diamonds. It's about the rough. Some sitcoms were briefly popular in their time. Some were canceled almost immediately. You probably won't recognize most of these, and you'll ask, that was a show?
That was a show?
The podcast about failed or forgotten sitcoms from the 80s and 90s, starring
Bryn Burney,
Aaron Yeager,
and Andrew Helmer as Barry.
A Radio Gizmo production.
Welcome to the program, Simone. I am really mad at you for making me watch this.
I'm mad at myself, man.
Well, we all knew. Like, there's no way we knew. Yeah, like,
we all knew what we were getting into here.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So before we get into talking about the show, this is actually a bit of a milestone. This is our 40th episode of That Was a Show.
And wow, yay us.
I would like to officially introduce our special guest co-host to the audience. Simone Smith is a Canadian Screen Award-winning film and television editor with a ridiculous number of credits. In addition to being a friend and fellow sitcom fan, we've actually collaborated on a couple of film projects, so we've experienced her incredible talent firsthand. Simone, welcome to That Was a Show.
Thanks so much for having me and for that really nice intro.
So, I've got a few brief interviewee style questions for you to kind of help everyone get to know you a little bit better. So, we'll start off with a fun, simple one. What's your favorite sitcom from the 80s or 90s?
I mean, I was raised in the Church of Seinfeld. It was always on in my home. Yeah. And I feel like you can like Seinfeld and you can like Friends, but you are truly in your core either a Seinfeld or a Friends person. And so, yeah, I am of the Seinfeld religion.
Perfect. So you'll fit in well with us. Do you have a favorite new comedy that is currently on TV?
I've been really enjoying The After Party, the Apple Plus show.
Okay.
I don't know if you guys have seen it.
Haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, it's like a murder mystery, and each person's perspective on the events is like shot and told in a different genre. So you have like a rom-com telling and like a Fast and Furious Michael Bay kind of styles. And like they completely change the style of the show for each individual telling.
Oh, that's fun.
And it's really funny. And it's directed by Chris Miller. So I don't know if you're a Lord Miller fan, it's that same kind of like zany humor. So, yeah.
That great. Sounds cool. Amazing.
Yeah.
It's on my list. I'm very excited to watch that.
We got to check that out.
Well, I'll definitely check that out. Maybe tonight. And here's a question more specifically about your work. Have you ever worked as an editor on a TV comedy series? He asked rhetorically as if he doesn't already know that you did.
Yes, I actually worked on a spinoff, so this is extra well-suited. I was an editor on Strays, which was the spinoff of Kim's Convenience.
Ah, right on.
And so, brief follow-up question to that. Can you tell us a little bit about what that process is like? And my biggest curiosity is that balance between maintaining an established format for a show versus like to what extent you can inject your own sort of style and creativity?
Yeah, it really is always kind of a balance back and forth where, like, especially because it was my first time cutting a sitcom, you know, I was playing things a little bit longer, you know, coming from not only film, but mostly dramatic film. I think it took me a bit to really push the pacing to, like, TV comedy is cut so fast. So just getting used to that and then, like, really embracing the style. But I find in anything I work on, you know, ultimately I have to kind of fit my sensibilities into the confines of whatever it is I'm doing. So, you know, I treat Strays differently from, like, you know, a slow, sad drama.
Yeah. Amazing. And we'll definitely take a moment to talk a little bit more about some stuff like this at the end of the episode. But for now, maybe we should jump into it. Why don't you tell us all about Ferris Bueller, the sitcom?
Bueller.
Oh, boy. I mean, I knew it was going to be bad. Like, it's just an ill-advised thing to do. I mean, it's a beloved film with very low stakes. How are you going to draw that into a whole series? The answer is you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a huge, huge fan of the film. I watched it obsessively growing up, taped off TV, because that's what you did back in the day. You didn't, like, buy movies. I actually rewatched the film yesterday. I'm like, I still remember where some of the commercial breaks were and, like, wow, the tape I watched as a kid.
That's so funny.
Yeah, so just love the film, and I had no idea, you know, even being a fan of it for all these years, that someone dare make a sitcom of it, and it existed, and, you know, was available to watch, so, yeah. So, the Ferris Bueller sitcom, it's technically all the same characters you know and love from the film, but now they're in Santa Monica instead of Chicago, and, yeah. Not very good.
I also thought it might be fun to put this sitcom in a little bit of context for the time. This is not something we usually do, but I couldn't help myself but, like, look up what were the top shows in that year and, like, what were they up against? Because, like you said, like, the John Hughes film that it's based on had a huge cultural impact at the time. So expectations would have been high. And so the 1990 to 1991 television season in America, these are U.S. statistics, 7 of the top 10 shows were sitcoms. And of the other 3, one was 60 Minutes, one was football, and one was America's Funniest Home Videos. So none of those were scripted. So all of the top scripted shows were sitcoms. And in fact, of the top 30 shows, 20 were sitcoms. So it was a year when this format was, like, the thing dominating TV, and that movie being as popular as it was, this would have been presumably an attempt at doing something big.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel like it could be just one of those things where last episode we talked about Working Girl, and that was another movie that came out at the tail end of the 80s, and then they did the sitcom and then, like, early 90s. And this could be the same thing where it's, like, a few years, like, something that's huge in the 80s, at the end of the 80s, maybe is just, like, doomed to fail if they try to bring it into the 90s.
Yeah, there must have been a, and I feel bad not knowing what it is. So yeah, Tune in next episode when I come back with this.
Yeah.
But there must have been a project that convinced them,
yeah,
they should start greenlighting these things. There must have been a successful sitcom,
yeah,
right. Jeez. Around the early 90s that just told them, okay, this worked. What else can we do? Because why are these coming out 5 years later, right? I mean,
yeah.
A League of Their Own was only a year after the movie, so yeah, we'll scrap that one. But yeah, Working Girl and Ferris Bueller, you got a couple of years in between here, right? So it's kind of weird that, especially for Ferris Bueller, it's weird that the project came along, you know, 4.5 years later.
Yeah,
there, right.
So you'd think everybody'd be over it by then. It's like, oh yeah, yeah, we get this.
But you're right. Yeah. This is our third bad adaptation episode, and yeah, all of these shows, like, we're not doing this intentionally, but all of these sitcoms based on successful movies seem yeah, to be hitting yeah, around 1990. Like, that seems yeah, to be a time when they were just doing this type of adaptation a lot.
Was something yeah, going on? Were people like? like just out of ideas in 1990, like in terms of sitcoms, and they were just like, oh my God, like we have to just...
They're easy sell, you know, they're easy sells. Yeah. It's an interesting, yeah, but it's weird. This show is definitely interesting in that it, like you said, it takes all the characters we know and love and makes it so we neither know nor love them any longer.
I mean, basically, yeah. I think it's important to say that it debuted in August, which is an awkward time. Like, so it debuted in August 1990. So it was like right before the fall, like lineup would have started. So maybe that had something to do with it. I don't know.
That is an odd time.
And it was canceled within its first season. So there's not like, it didn't really stand a chance.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting is like this being our third iteration of this type of thing. So A League of Their Own, like just to summarize for Simone and where we're at, you know, A League of Their Own kind of played it like a sequel.
Yeah.
And it was pretty obvious to all three of us watching it. Like it had some potential, but it was canceled for a reason. Then we did Working Girl, totally different thing. They treated it as its own like reboot in a parallel universe, borrowing some elements of the premise, but modifying other elements to like really suit the format well.
To improve it. It's much. We really enjoyed Working Girl.
All three of us liked it way better than the movie and thought it was a show that deserved to succeed. This is neither of those two categories.
No.
This is a show that...
This is trying to capitalize on the meta-ness of the movie by making it in between, right?
What did everyone think of that opening?
So, okay, I've been dying to say something. So I actually didn't hate that whole thing of him being aware of the movie and that the whole... like pretense of like, oh, this is the real Ferris Bueller and that movie was like based on him. Like that's a fun idea. But then they totally screwed with it because they took other characters and screwed with the timeline.
Yeah, there was no continuity.
Yeah, because it was like Sloan was a new student.
Yeah.
But yet in the movie, he's like been dating her for a while.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know. So it's kind of like there's some odd liberties, but like, which to me reeks of like network notes, like somebody coming back and being like, oh, we got to like change this, this or this. And it's like, but that won't work now because we did this whole meta thing and whatever. But I don't know. I actually didn't hate that. I actually thought that could have been fun if they did it like a little differently. Like I thought it would be kind of fun if like it was like, oh, no, this is like this movie was like about my life and I'm like upset about it or whatever.
Like, maybe if honestly, if it ever it felt like there was so little thought given to it, except for they thought it would be funny for that one joke.
Yeah,
but it's never referenced again.
Right, it's never referenced again. It doesn't.
Yeah, like
referenced in the other episode we watched.
He hasn't met Sloan yet, so it's kind of weird. Like, it's just sort of, and also like I don't want to say bad taste, but like it's really tacky. To like
to chainsaw the cutout of Matthew Broderick.
It would be one thing if for some reason, you know, in the 5 years it had intervened, for some reason, you know, maybe Broderick got canceled or something. But like he was a beloved actor and you were an inferior performance. So don't pretend like it was earned for you to do this. Like you're a nobody. You're an absolute nobody, and you are taking a chainsaw to one of the most iconic performances of the 80s.
I thought it was funny that he calls him white bread and
white
then proceeds to be the most like white bread guy ever.
Yeah.
Ever. Ever. Yeah. I wanted to say
he's like waspy. He's like way like I had a problem with that casting.
I'm gonna have to do a drinking game every time you say somebody's waspy.
I know, I say waspy a lot.
So,
I have a problem.
So
with-
the original Ferris Bueller was like kind of this countercultural icon. Because he seemed to be rebelling against the times that he was living in and kind of speaking to, I think, what later became identified as a Gen X thing, but like a certain kind of alienation to the corporate world and to the working world and the idea of school just being something that like sets you up for the same jobs that their parents had and a certain cynicism. And everything about him felt like, okay, he's going against the grain of the system. And this guy feels like he is absolutely the most kind of conformist, preppy, like privileged, like not rebellious at all. Other than he just cuts class. He just cuts class. Otherwise, he's like just totally a conformist.
And he's a dick.
Yeah,
and
he
to
is.
To everyone.
He's manipulative and he's scary. Like, my biggest note that kind of got Aaron laughing was he walked in the room while I was watching and I said, is he Ferris Bueller or is he Patrick Bateman?
It's true.
I had that too.
He was terrifying. Like, I thought he was actually like a psychopath. Like, the way he was manipulating the situations was not, it was more in a sinister way, in my opinion. Like, he was like fully like mirror, like putting on a complete fake persona, not like, oh, I'm trying to pull off a fun scheme. It was like, no, I will like be the puppet master to get Sloan to like me. And he doesn't seem to actually like Sloan because he like makes fun of her a lot. Yeah.
He has no interest in her as a human being, nor does the show itself.
No, it's like, oh, she's pretty, and I'm just going to, like, you know, manipulate things so that she's just around me, and, like, it's creepy and terrifying. Go ahead,
Bateman. Bateman is a great, great reference on that, because honestly, watching this, it just over and over and over again hammered home what a great performance Matthew Broderick gives.
Yes.
Because what a tightrope he's walking. What a tightrope he's walking, which is exactly what the phrase is, but I had to repeat it twice. For the people listening at home, you're hearing us describe this, you know, some sociopathic behavior from this Ferris Bueller character. You're probably thinking to yourself, well, that's in the movie. Because it is.
It is.
It absolutely is. He is manipulative and conniving, and he does toe a really weird line. But because of Matthew Broderick, we're on his side. He's charming. You know, he does manipulate Sloan and Cameron in the movie, but we see that he truly cares about them. So it's okay.
There are this people to him, not just like things to like bend to his will. Like, it's...
Yeah.
So my exact note, I didn't write down Patrick Bateman, but I put a few of these similar types of comparisons. I had him as a selfish narcissist that's kind of a pairing of Eddie Haskell crossed with Dennis from It's Always Sunny. And then later, I also had to write down Dollar Store Zach Morris.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Who is himself a dollar store Ferris Bueller.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Zach Morris was more charming still. Like,
again, performance.
Yeah. Performance means
everything.
Yeah. It also got me wondering, like, is Zach Morris? And then I was also reading there was another show, Parker Lewis Can't Lose, that I hadn't heard of, where there's these charming characters that deal with the principal and break the fourth wall. Like, that was, I guess, just a trope for a while. And like, did Ferris start that?
I would say so.
They just kept like repurposing it over and over again.
I think it started in Shakespeare with with Iago, because all the way it's Iago, right? And in Othello, that's like the very first like break the fourth wall.
But wasn't there a principal?
No, there's no principle. There's no principle.
Oh, you're talking about like soliloquies. Yeah, for sure.
Like breaking the fourth wall and like talking about plans.
Yeah.
You know, like that was like the whole like commenting on what's going on in the story world.
I was just like, I don't know if any of these people outwardly insulted their audience like the Ferris Bueller in the show does.
Yeah. He's telling us to dress better.
Yeah. I looked down because, okay, so the end of the first episode, because, you know, he's been talking to the audience the whole time and he's like, hey, you know, if you're going to come back next week, why don't you try to dress better? You know, if you're hanging with Ferris Bueller, you got to have a little style. And I actually did look down and go, oh.
Yeah. And you know what, though? He doesn't dress as cool as Ferris in the movie.
Nope.
Ferris in the movie is
awful.
Yes. Ferris in the movie is like a hipster. He's got that fun vest and stuff. And like, yeah, he's got like a
bit of
swagger.
This guy's wearing a leisure suit.
Yeah. No, this guy is wearing like, in the first episode we watch, he's super preppy. So it's like boring. Yeah. It's like the boring preppy look of the early 90s, late 80s. And then in the second episode, he's wearing kind of a fun, like sweatshirt that is like the color blocking thing that's like iconic 90s, but it is still very preppy. It's still what the like cool jock guys would wear. And I'm like, meh, like not for me. Like we need like a hip, like cool, you know, counterculture Ferris Bueller.
Yeah. So speaking of style, were these the worst opening credits ever seen in a sitcom ever? I don't know if they're like top five or the worst.
I don't understand why they did it on blue screen. He's walking through a door. Just have him walk through the door.
Yeah, yeah.
They had the money to license Beach Boys songs. They couldn't like...
I know. Not, I mean...
Not every week.
Not every week. Not every week.
Not every week.
But they...
These are my second least favorite titles we've ever watched. The first being Davis Rules.
Yeah, it was basically like, yeah, we have this blue screen. We got to use it. We got to like, you know, so it's like him pointing to things and
like nauseating.
It's really triggering. It's like, oh, my God. And then the again, we already kind of referenced the score, the Bueller.
Bueller.
Ferris Bueller.
The it's only just... lyrics in the... So for the audience to understand, the opening music of this show, the only lyrics in it is the name Ferris Bueller being repeated over and over again at varying rhythms and speeds. That's it. That's all they say.
It felt like they were... trying to do the oh yeah yellow thing like that style, but making it a theme song and it just doesn't translate.
Maybe kind of mixing in Ben Stein a little in there, you know, because that's the other iconic thing from the movie.
It kind of feels like a bit of a Mad Libs. Like I would say an algorithm wrote it, but this was pre-algorithm. Like I feel like it's maybe a bit like of a Mad Libs sitcom like premise, because basically they took like popular characters, popular things, and then like all the tropes and like threw it together. Like even the chainsaw thing at the beginning, like that is a bit of a trope. Like that is like, I feel like that was a thing in 80s commercials and 90s commercials where they would just like, whenever they were making like a fun joke about like, you know, oh, we're cutting prices or we're whatever. It was like, you always took a chainsaw to it. Like there's like, a fascination with chainsaws, you know, it's chock full of tropes. Like, you know, Jennifer Aniston's character, and we didn't even get to that yet. Like that.
Yeah, Jennifer Aniston's here.
Jennifer Aniston's in this, guys.
Yeah, Jennifer Aniston is there. You know, she plays the failed shows she had before she became Rachel Green and like took over television.
And what
in the
show
90s.
Is that?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Some little show that nobody's heard of.
Muddling Through? Was it Muddling Through?
Yeah, it was Muddling Through.
We're working our way backwards in her. Yeah. We're working our way backwards in her oeuvre. We did Muddling Through, now this, and eventually we're going to have to do the first one.
Her very first failed sitcom, which was, I don't even know if it did a full season.
What? I think it's like Malloy. 7 episodes or something.
Oh, Malloy. Oh,
yeah,
we'll get to
Mayim Bialik.
We'll see y'all in season 11.
Yeah. Exactly. But yeah, like I think she did a good job. Like but it's like not a good part. Like it's like the same as the Jennifer Grey character in the movie. It's like a tropey, bitchy older sister. Like that is very much like an 80s trope. It's like, there's always like the bitchy teenage sister who's just like, for no reason at all, just like hates her younger brother. And like, obviously
he sucks.
I know he sucks. I know he sucks. I'm just saying that is like a trope of like.
This time I got it.
Yeah, this time I get it.
I'm like, on her side. He's a piece of shit.
He is torturing her. But yeah, like she does like a good job with it. And she's funny, I guess, but it is like just like a very like flatly written part.
Speaking of flat, Simone, I'm glad you brought up the editing style that you were talking about with TV comedy, how it tends to be really fast. And I wanted to ask you your opinion of the editing in this, which I found to be like unusually slow and halting and awkward for a TV comedy of the time.
Yeah, it struck me that it really felt like it was trying to be maybe their idea of cinematic. And but by episode 7, that is also totally gone. Like they're in full on like sitcom trope, like we're starting with an establisher of the house and a little sting, you know, yeah. Like, abandon any of those choices like by mid-season.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah. I'm also curious about this whole like single cam versus multicam thing, because this show, you know, they're going for a single cam style. And one thing I've noticed over the course of our podcast is that that was something that was attempted in the late 80s and early 90s a lot more than I thought it was, because a lot, I feel yeah. like the shows that are truly like massive successes from that time are almost without exception multicam stage play style live studio audience sitcoms. And so I guess I was always under the impression that like that's all they made back then. But it seems like a lot of the shows that failed were attempts at single cam comedies. But like to your point, maybe they didn't know what that meant yet, or like they were trying to go cinematic in all the wrong ways. So yeah. just like I'm curious, Simone, your take on like maybe what they were trying to do as a visual style there and whether any of it worked.
Yeah, I mean, like it felt like maybe they're trying to bridge that gap from, you know, knowing it as a film, but now reintroducing it as a sitcom. And, you know, they have all these establishing shots of Santa Monica and stuff, like a lot going on. And then, you know, by episode 7, there's like almost none of that. So feels like they also really blew the budget on that pilot for sure. Music, definitely.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You got Beach Boys, you got B-52s in there. And yeah, I feel like they had budget for one episode and one episode yeah. only.
They
and,
have some bangers in that. A lot, yeah.
lot of location shooting in the first yeah. episode, next to none by the seventh.
Yeah.
Do we think that's why they set it in California, just because it would be easier for the like location shoots, and then they like scrapped
yeah.
that?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I find it annoying that everything's set in like every sitcom is set in New York or California.
Yeah,
like well, there are some in Chicago, but it's like very few. Like it's I don't yeah. know.
The other thing is that like
it's ease. It's yeah. ease. That's all.
The other thing about the multicam sitcoms is that they tended to be like pretty low concept, because it was always reliant on like, we just want you to enjoy spending time with these people who are funny people. And you don't need lots of sets. You don't need like high concept plots. It's more just like these people are hanging out and let's watch them do their thing and be funny and like do a lot of fast paced jokes. And today, like, TV comedy is generally single cam, but it's also generally like much more high concept and much more like sophisticated plot construction. This show strikes me as something that would have worked better as like, let's keep it low key, let's keep it low concept. Because what is the premise? It's just like a guy who likes to cut class a lot. Like there's not yeah. there's not yeah. enough to it to warrant trying to go cinematic.
Well, he's a schemer, and you want to keep the fourth wall breaking, which really, you know, obviously that works on stage, but it doesn't necessarily work when you're doing it in a three camera sitcom. You don't see it as much. So how do you do it, right? Like there are some examples I can think of that managed it, like the sitcom Titus, which starred Christopher Titus, had the fourth wall breaking where he talked to the camera. The rest of the show was multicam. Those were always done on a set. So with, you know, just single cam. So it works, but you got to put a lot more effort into it. So I think if you want, I don't think you can make a Ferris Bueller show and cut out the concept of him talking to the camera. And yeah. I don't think you can do that in a multicam as successfully.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Good point.
That's fair. Especially within scenes, you know, sometimes part of the reaction is just like throwing the eye line to camera and then back to the scene.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So going back a bit to the idea of like this Ferris's personality and how much of a dick he was. One of my notes was like after the kiss, the wench line, and also the thing of him convincing her to carry his books and saying he has a bad back, and like even manipulating.
He's an asshole.
Even manipulating.
Right. So we should go back and talk yeah. about the episode itself, right? Yeah. So we watched two yeah. episodes for this.
I got my write ups. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Go for it.
Go
Describe
for it.
What happens in the two amazing episodes of Ferris Bueller that we watched.
All right. So for episode one, the pilot. It's the first day of school, and Ferris is trying to get to know a new transfer student named Sloane while avoiding his nemesis, Principal Rooney. Ferris manages to convince Sloane to cut class with him, and he steals his sister, Jeannie's, car. He gets caught by Rooney and sent to detention, but in typical Ferris style, puts a dummy in his place. Jeannie gets her car back, but gets pulled over since she reported it stolen. Assuming the cop is a prank from her brother, she flees the officer and gets arrested. Ferris hacks into the police computer system and sets her bail to $250,000.
So he's a hacker in this world, apparently.
He's also a hacker, yeah.
Which, I'm sorry, that was another Matthew Broderick movie. Ferris Bueller wasn't in War Games. Like, come on.
Yeah.
Although he does hacked for the number of days absent.
That's true. In the movie. That's true. He does.
Yeah, he does do that.
There's some light hacking.
It's within his skill set. Yeah. Absolutely.
I love how being a hacker in 1990 meant literally just having access to a computer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but correct. Again, if you were an early 90s hacker, you'd be more of like you'd either be like more of a nerd or a countercultural type, like a kind of a early cyberpunk, but he is like neither of those. He's still got all the hallmarks of a like kind of preppy popular douche, you know? Like he's got all the hallmarks of like who's the kid from Growing Pains?
Oh Mikey. Yeah.
Is it Mike Seaver?
Mike Seaver.
Yeah. Ugh.
The Republican.
Yeah. Or no, he is in real life a Republican, or is the character a Republican too? I can't remember. That Michael J. Fox in Family Ties is definitely a
Alex P. Keaton is
the Republican. Yeah.
Okay.
The confirmed Republican who's like a kid of two liberals. Right.
That wasn't as much of a loaded concept as it is now.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah, back then it wasn't quite as divisive. I guess it was, but like we weren't alive, so or if we were like tiny babies.
Did anyone else find the decor in his bedroom really odd?
I thought it was like a close enough approximation. Yeah, it was a decent discount version of the movie set.
Yeah, it was fine.
I didn't really notice the set design.
Maybe it's just too long since I've seen the movie. Yeah. Does he have like a massive Union Jack in the movie?
Oh, that was weird.
Yeah.
The Union Jack was weird.
Yeah, he does.
Oh, he does? Okay.
Yeah. I would say that's probably a punk thing.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. New wave kind of thing. Yeah.
But then make him a punk.
Sex Pistols.
Right.
With as much hacking as he does in this and all the other things, like I can't in any way ever seeing this Ferris like learning something.
Yeah.
Like when did he become a hacker? How did he even have the like how did he even free an afternoon up? Like from scheming to actually learn how to be a computer whiz.
Yeah, I don't even know.
True. Yeah. I mean, give me a jean jacket and long hair or something. Like at least give me superficial markers that would suggest that he's like radical. Come on.
Did anybody notice? Maybe it was me just reaching, but I felt like they dressed Sloan like Ferris. Like Sloan had the little like vest and like the, you know, the vest white tee combo that Ferris wore and like.
Oh, yeah, kind of.
Yeah. Okay, so you brought up so after they kiss, you know, Ferris Bueller does like one of his like look to cameras things and, you know, she trips and he's like, oh, she's a wench. She's klutzy, but a wench. The only thing I could think of
is, in a weird way,
I'm like, did wench briefly become something else in the 80s? Because that time didn't seem like he was. Yeah, he didn't seem like he was using it that way.
That's what your servers called at medieval times.
It's a salty barmaid.
Yeah.
It seemed, I don't know. I was.
Maybe it was briefly cool. Maybe a wench was cool. I don't know. Because
you know,
the way he uses it feels like it was like maybe we just missed some slang.
Maybe. I found it quite off-putting, but I don't know why.
It's a great word. I wish we had repurposed it, you know?
Let's bring it back.
To get one less. Yeah, like one less. Take it back. We need one less insulting word, you know? It's got a great sound to it.
Another trope to mention is like, of course, like a weird rivalry between a teenage boy and an adult. In this case, it's a principal. But like, I mean, that is like a huge 80s trope. But we've seen it in other forms where, like when we watched It's Your Move, there was like the weird rivalry between Jason Bateman's character and David Garrison's character.
Dennis the Menace.
Yeah, like there's like these weird rivalries where a child, let's be honest, a child and a fully grown man are like going toe to toe in like a cat and mouse game. And it's just Tracy, what was that all about?
Tracy Flick and Matthew Broderick again.
Yeah,
in
yeah,
election.
Later on in election. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of my favorite things about Rooney in this is that Rooney in this is played by Richard Reel, replacing Jeffrey Jones, famously as the as Principal Rooney. For geeks out there, Richard Reel also replaced the male authority character in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer TV show, replacing Donald Sutherland as her watcher Merrick in the show. So I found it was weird that they were just like, who can we get to replace this iconic actor?
This movie character, yeah.
And then they were like, I don't know, what about this other iconic actor who
Richard
likes to, who comes to play these things?
He keeps it real.
And, you know, let's get serious. He wants to jump to conclusions.
I was going to mention that later in the spinoff.
Well, I didn't mention it yet.
You didn't give me a chance, you know.
Well, you can still bring it up later. I didn't say what it was from.
He's your go-to, like, generic authority figure that pisses people off just by, like...
But he's also silly. You know.
He's also somebody, as somebody who works in finance, he's also somebody that works in every single office.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just that guy in an office who's like miserable and like about to have like a, you know, about to.
He's the first guy to show up at like whenever there's birthday cake.
Yeah. Whenever there's birthday cake and he's about to like snap like on somebody if they ask him too much about what he's doing with his day. And
yeah.
Or is that just his office based character? I guess. Anyway.
So you guys mentioned the trope of the cat and mouse game between the student and principal. The other trope, I think, that's kind of an offshoot of that with the high school principal in sitcoms is that they always seem to like devote a good chunk of their time to like trying to like desperately trying to discipline one or two particular students. Like, it's as if there's very little else going on administratively in their jobs that, like, a school that probably has over 1,000 kids, they're usually, like, pretty much just setting their sights on that one person who's pissing them off. As if, like, they don't have to, like, do anything else. Like, it doesn't quite make sense that they would even be this aware of the comings and goings of any particular student, but... Yeah,
it's funny you mentioned that.
It's like,
yeah,
he's obsessed.
Yeah,
it's funny you mentioned that because actually that does segue really nicely into episode 7, which actually in some way deals with exactly that from his character.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
That was a show.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Hey, honey, why haven't you eaten your toast?
I don't know. I guess I'm just sick of this regular boring peanut butter.
Well, maybe it's time we make our meals an adventure.
Whoa, what's this? Wonder Nut Butter?
Try it.
Wow, it's good. It's spiced, but not spicy.
You're such a witty and precocious child.
Spread the world with Wonder Nut Butter's internationally inspired flavors. It's made with only peanuts, spices, and salt, and no added sugar. Try every flavor of Wonder Nut Butter's today.
I don't know. That kid sounded a little old.
Really? I thought it was pretty good casting.
That commercial failed to mention that Wonder is based right here in Toronto, Canada.
Or that you can eat Wonder Nut Butters as a healthy snack, like, you know, adding it to a smoothie.
Also, there are 3 flavors available, inspired by spices from India, Morocco, or Thailand.
I really liked the Moroccan peanut butter on toast with apricot or peach jam.
I've tried Wonder. It's delicious. It looked so enticing. These ads really work.
You can even cook with it, like if you're making a soup or a sauce.
We've been talking a really long time about this commercial.
Yeah, wait, is this meta? Are we part of a commercial? Is Wander a sponsor if that was a show?
All I know is that our listeners can get a 15% discount when they order Wander Nut Butters online at tastewander.com/twas. That's taste, WANDER.com/TWAS and use the coupon code TWAS15 at checkout. And you can follow them at taste.wander on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok.
What are you reading from? Where is that? You didn't answer any of my questions.
Okay, Simone, why don't you set us up for episode 7?
All right. Episode 7. Sloane is obsessed with astrology and drags Ferris to a book signing with a psychic. The psychic warns him that he has a black aura and will have bad luck until his planets are in retrograde. Or out of retrograde. Is it in retrograde or out of retrograde?
I don't know anything about that stuff.
I don't know. Sloane, taking it seriously, decides she should avoid Ferris until the curse is lifted. Cameron and Jeannie are rehearsing lines for the school play, and Ferris's parents are going to write their wills, causing some marital strife. When Rooney catches Ferris impersonating him on a phone call, he brings Ferris to his office to officially expel him. An earthquake hits town, trapping everyone. Ferris is stuck in Rooney's office, and his parents are trapped in an elevator with a chicken mascot, and the situation brings all three pairs closer together.
That's a great way to summarize it. Now, of course, the psychic was right that Sloane should avoid Ferris just for very different reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was nice by episode 7 to learn a second thing about Sloane.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But and like the way that at the beginning of the episode, he was basically, talking smack about her. He's like, oh, she likes psychics and stuff. I'll just pretend I like it because like, it's not even enough for him to be like, oh, my girlfriend's like into this thing, which I think is, he could like tell her to her face that he thinks it's kind of silly, but like he's so manipulative that he like pretends. Yeah. But then he sort of believes it because he starts to think that he's cursed after this like reading. But I feel like, that's again, we're heavily into tropes. Like I feel like psychics and things like that were definitely a trope in 80s and 90s.
Well, they still are.
Yeah, they still are.
Classic comedy.
People having a curse. And then, of course, being trapped in an elevator, like characters getting trapped in elevators together or getting trapped in a room together. Like that's always
according to the 90s, elevators were like very prone to problems.
You're just bound to being stuck like. You know, you're just like at some point it's inevitable that you're going to be stuck in an elevator with someone that you either don't like or you have tension with. Like there's always just going to be,
Yeah. And 10% of the time someone will pee in the corner of the elevator when they're stuck there long enough. Yeah.
I've been stuck in an elevator and it was quite dramatic. And somebody did indeed pee in the corner of the elevator.
Whoa. I'm sorry. I need to hear more about this.
Sometime.
Whoa. Okay. Put everything else on hold.
But that's another podcast.
Oh, boy.
I'm not. Trust me.
Can't
I'm
it
not,
be this one? No.
Well, maybe off the record.
Oh, boy. I mean, I do enjoy like how that trope, like they did that in The Office in an episode where Dwight, like, he establishes, he gets stuck in the elevator with Pam because Pam like she's pranking him.
I remember that.
Yeah. And then he pees in the corner to establish a pee corner and he won't stop drinking water because he's got like the big like backpack water bottle thing.
Yeah.
So trope can be fun, but
I found the chicken mascot thing immediately very confusing. And this might be because I missed some detail, but who or what was that and why did it work its way into the plot?
There's no detail. No detail at all. It just shows up. It's tonally so out of place. I don't know what that was about.
At no point are we ever in any way, is it suggested that there might be a person in there? That is somebody playing a mascot? Because it never takes the head off. It completely interacts, well, almost completely silently throughout the whole thing.
Until
somebody at the network was like, I don't know, I feel like this this chicken character might just be really misogynistic.
One of the things I noticed, especially coming out of that character, is that like some aspects of this show are kind of cartoonish, like kind of pushing outside the realm of the kind of like realism that you expected from Ferris Bueller, the movie. But like, it doesn't go far enough in that direction to feel like an intentional choice. It just comes across as like random nonsense, like ideas that someone like threw a noodle at the wall to see what would stick and no one ever remembered to cut it out of the script.
I definitely missed Alan Ruck as Cameron in this because like in the movie, he's just so good at playing like an anxiety like riddled like hypochondriac. Yeah, yeah. Like he's just so perfect in that, you know, in the movie. And then like this guy, like he's a good actor, Brandon Douglas, who takes the role. But it's just like they didn't push the character far enough with the writing or anything. Like, you know,
he's very empty.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not
and too cool.
Yeah.
Like he's social.
Yeah. He's better than Ferris.
Yeah. It's true. It's like they're all way too cool. It's almost like they were like, oh, we don't want the characters to be, you know, too edgy or hipster. Like, we just really want to sand off their edges and make them, like, you know, potentially popular kids in school.
I think it's
like
it's the parents' dream of the Ferris Bueller movie.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I just don't see a world in which the Alan Ruck Cameron Fry would be in drama class. Like performing
exactly
on stage, outrageous.
Yeah,
right.
He would have had Ferris get him out of that.
He would have lived. Yeah. You know.
Well, no. Were they in drawn? He was helping her.
He was Was he in the class, or is he just helping her with her lines?
They're different ages. He was helping her with her lines.
But he's somehow involved in drama because he knew the teacher and stuff.
Why was he? Why would he be an? Why would he be an expert? That's a good question.
And like the whole thing of Jeannie being involved in drama as like something for her college, like resume, basically, like, oh, I need extra credit. I need like more things. And it's like, what? I don't know if like I've joined the debate team then. Like, I feel like.
Yeah, because one of her things, wasn't there a line where she says something about how if she's forced to like keep running these lines, she may like inadvertently memorize the entire script. And someone's like, but isn't that what you're supposed to do? And she's like, no, I'm just doing this for extra credit. I don't actually want to like put in the time to take it seriously. Like there was something to the effect of like,
odd.
She doesn't actually want to be good at it.
Yeah, because she's an understudy.
Well,
she should still know it all.
Yeah, but I feel like there's also this like undercurrent of being like, oh, we do not want to appeal to artsy or countercultural teens. This is for the cool kids.
Well,
understudies, they're a shady bunch.
Yeah, but then the whole episode is she's learning that the play is cool. So
yeah, true. But I feel like there's not enough to like get you to like it. I don't know. I just like I found myself being very distracted and like
I could never figure out whether it was a real play they were talking about.
yeah, it was a real play. Like it was, wasn't it? Was it the Glass Menagerie? Is that what they were doing?
I don't know. If it was, then yes, that's a real play.
Yeah.
But yeah, they didn't get into it enough. And like all the vague things where I was like, this sounds like it could be real, or it sounds like you're bullshitting me.
It's like, yeah, they took a real play and they kind of like changed little details and changed little things because they were like, oh, we don't know if we can actually reference this play.
So the meat of this episode, of course, is Rooney and Ferris get trapped in an office for probably the last half of the episode. And that's sort of, you know, where the dramatic conflict of the episode comes in. And it takes a weird turn in that it's just like Rooney is finally about to expel Ferris. And then he realizes that Ferris is the only thing in his life that gives it any meaning, which is like
really
a real... Yeah, which is like a real, like, you know, Batman and the Joker thing where they're going to do this dance forever. But it's really early in the series to come to that point of
Episode
view.
Episode 7. And and they don't like dance around it in a comedic sort of subtext way. He just like comes out and directly basically says, you are the only thing that gives my life meaning. And I need
while
to like
wearing not- only his undershirt,
while,
by the way,
while stripping off of his clothes and like sweating profusely and just like he's the principal of the school. Dignity,
and,
man.
Yeah, and Ferris, of course, being the complete monster that he is, just sort of sits there and let this man bare his soul to him and doesn't really react in any way.
Yeah. Well, I think he does love that someone thinks about him that often, though. You know,
that's true.
Like a true psychopath.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No,
he is getting off on it.
It reminded me a little of the scene.
He hasn't even begun to peak.
Yeah.
it reminded me in like not a funny way though of the scene in Seinfeld when Newman's interrogating Jerry at the post office for like perceived mail fraud, but the hot lamp is entirely over him. So he's the like one sweating. Who's like sweating profusely and getting really intense. And Sherry's just sitting back, feeling light and breezy and sipping a soda. And it was like that sort of thing where like they were having two very different experiences from each other being locked in this office. And it didn't feel like there was thought put into like an emotional arc or like revelation that's coming out of this interaction, because it didn't even feel like they were in the room together. It's almost like the principal might as well have been running lines with like just some stand-in to help him get through the scene.
That would actually explain Ferris's performance. I mean, perhaps this boy was the stand-in and then they just left him in all the scenes.
Charlie Schlatter, the stand-in.
Yeah.
Sorry, Charlie Schlatter.
I mean, he wasn't bad.
Sorry, devoted listener Charlie Schlatter.
Yeah, exactly. He's not listening to this.
Yeah, he's a devoted listener.
So, Simone, one thing that we do frequently on this show that you may have noticed is that we call out these specific tropes that we discover in these shows and kind of build on this growing library of sitcom tropes that we're developing. So do you have any thoughts on that, like that we haven't identified yet, like tropes that you'd like to officially label?
I don't know. Like, yeah, you've already touched upon the principal cat and mouse thing, which I think is like the major trope here. And I feel like the show could have done with more tropes even. Like, at least that would have been something.
Yeah.
It would have had some flavor.
We had the elevator. Yeah. We had the elevator. There's a trope.
Yeah, the elevator. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like getting two regular characters to kiss by rehearsing a play is a trope.
Yeah.
That is.
Oh, yeah.
It's a trope and also like a shameless ploy employed in real life, I'm sure. But
I feel like there's something there with like the older sister that hates the quote unquote nerdy friend. And then they end up kissing or making out. Like that's a thing secretly. Like there's a secret romantic spark between two characters who are supposed to hate each other. That's definitely like a 90s trope.
For sure.
I feel like there's something in the relationship between the parents, but I can't quite put my finger on it. That particular dynamic, like that we see at the sort of breakfast table and the dad, maybe something around the fact that like the dad seems to be like dodging interaction with his family or something like that.
Yeah, the distant father behind a newspaper trope. There you go.
There you go.
That's what it is. That's what we'll call it. You're right.
Who needs tropes when that's just real life?
Yeah. But remember when like people used to read newspapers while they ate their breakfast and drank coffee and weren't like scrolling on a phone? Like
that's still a thing at my mom's house. My mom gets the paper every day and reads it while she eats breakfast.
There you go. Keeping print media alive.
Yeah.
Just going back to the Cameron Genie thing. So we all watch this on YouTube and there's comments, and there are so many earnest comments for people being like, yeah, Cameron and Genie, I just want to see them be together. Like people are still holding on to this, like wanting this relationship to be real, like 30 years later.
Wow.
I can see, like, every time I watch the movie, like, I always just want the best for Cameron.
Yeah.
Yes, like, exactly.
I even briefly, like, I feel like I remember being younger and being like, you know, he should be with Sloane. They're way nicer to each other than, like, Ferris and Sloane are.
I remember in the movie finding it really odd that they, like, walked around hand in hand in certain scenes. I'm like, that's, like, a very intimate thing to do with, like, your friend's girlfriend. Your best friend's girlfriend.
They did have a very interesting dynamic between the three.
Yeah, were
of them.
They actually a throuple? Like,
I mean, he watched her change.
Yeah,
when he was catatonic.
He did.
I think
they have to do a lot of emotional leaning on each other because they're neither of them are getting what they need from Ferris.
Yeah, they're not getting enough emotional, you know, even though, as we've established, the Matthew Broderick Ferris was more of a feeling human being.
So one last question that I'd like to pose for Simone. So you'd mentioned how much you loved the movie and how many times you've watched it, including like in the lead up to our recording. So I'm just curious now, in the context of everything we've like picked apart from this show, what are maybe the things that you love most about the movie that, you know, regrettably didn't work out in the show, or like things that you would have been looking for that they would have done right?
I think like what's so great about the movie is it's this like wish fulfillment of like a perfect day as a teen where you like shirk all responsibility, you do all this fun stuff, but you can't do that every episode of a show. Yeah. So it's, yeah, that's like the magic to me, especially as a kid, I think, seeing someone else's rebellion, because I was so well behaved. Like I just kind of live vicariously through that. Like, this must be what it's like to break the rules. So cool. Never going to do it. But, and yeah, it's just really hard to translate that to a show. Like it really works only as like a single perfect day setup.
Yeah.
And then also just making it California like every other California teen show. I mean, dare I say Chicago is a character in itself in the film.
Agreed.
And I think it was missing that.
Yeah.
Yep.
You dare.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. The film had like a tangible backdrop to the story in a way that this show feels like, even if they wanted to make it a different part of America for some reason, and I don't know why they had to, but even if you were going to do California, they weren't showing countercultural or gritty or interesting parts of California. It was just like,
yeah, why didn't they make it like a skateboarder or something?
Like,
you know?
Yeah. What? Like, let's just like walk near the beach, I guess, to show that we're in California. But like, there was nothing of like 1990 LA probably had a lot of cool, like,
these kids were not, because these kids aren't cool,
you know?
Yeah, why are they at the Viper Room or something?
Yeah, they're not sneaking out to see like any of the cool bands from the 90s.
Exploring like early grunge music or something like that. Yeah. Like, they could have at least done that.
Sorry, the Viper Room.
The Viper Room. Man.
Cameron, I'm really messed up, man. You're never going to believe what happened last night.
Oh boy.
Oh, geez.
I don't know if like the Chicago thing is just sort of like, I think because we're a bunch of Canadians, like the Midwest, I think, sort of appeals to us more, and we can like relate to like that backdrop a little more.
It's John Hughes, so I mean, I feel like it probably took place in Shermer, right? They all take place in Shermer, Illinois, and then. That's like the fake, that's John Hughes's fake town in Illinois that all his scripts take place in, which is Chicago adjacent always, because they always need to get there for script reasons.
Yeah, they need to, like, that's the big city that they're trying to get to.
But you're right, Chicago is the most Canadian-American big city. I've heard many people remark that over the years.
Yeah.
Don't let Chicago hear you.
So, Bryn, how would you like to connect Ferris Bueller, the sitcom, with the more iconic sitcom, Friends?
Oh, geez, how many on this one?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest, obvious, glaring thing is that Rachel Green herself, Jennifer Aniston, was on this sitcom. So it's right away, the whole entire show is like one degree from Friends. I think it's kind of funny, Simone, that you mentioned the whole Church of Seinfeld. We're definitely also the Church of Seinfeld in this house, but you wouldn't know it with the amount of times we bring up Friends on this sitcom. You would think we're super fans of Friends.
Friends,
but
on this podcast, you mean.
Oh, sorry, on this podcast. Like, what are we? Are we a podcast or are we a sitcom at this point? But yeah, I mean, there are several other connections. Firstly, there's Christine Rose, who plays Barbara Bueller, so Ferris and Jeannie's mom. So she had a recurring role on Friends as Bitsy Hannigan, which was, guess who's mother-in-law?
Oh,
Phoebe Buffay's mother-in-law. Another Phoebe Buffay connection.
Oh, is she play Rudd? Does she play Rudd's mom?
Like Paul, Paul Rudd's mom, that character. So another mom. She plays a lot of moms. Like, if you look at her IMDb, she's all full of kind of like uppity mom characters. So that's one degree as well. We also have another one degree connection from one of the directors. So Arlene Sanford directed a couple of episodes of Ferris Bueller. She also was one of the listed directors from Friends. And we love to spotlight a woman director on this podcast. What else do we have here? Oh, okay. So we also have Richard Reel. This is a two-degree connection. He, of course, co-starred with Jennifer Aniston once again on Office Space. So that's another separate Jennifer Aniston connection to Friends. So that's like 2 degrees. And that's all I got. Because I mean, clearly, like, the biggest glaring one is the fact that it's got Jennifer Aniston.
Just to clear up, Bryn, I feel like any of our listeners in no way think we're not Seinfeld fans at this point. I mean, we've talked hours worth of Seinfeld on this podcast. Jeez, I almost did it too.
Can I give one brief rant about Friends?
Yeah, go for it.
I mentioned this to Aaron before too. They do not feel like New Yorkers to me. These are Californians.
No, they are.
100%.
Absolutely, they are.
It's not a New York show.
Yeah. No. They're the one thing, like Rachel, like in the later season, she's so tan all the time. And I feel like New Yorkers are like not that tan. That's like I lay out in my like LA backyard.
How are you going to tan?
You know, like that's like, yeah, they're definitely. And there's so many things about Friends that make zero sense. Like a bunch of 20 somethings in New York are not going to spend their entire time hanging out in either one person's apartment or
one coffee shop.
Yeah, one coffee shop and a couple of apartments. You're going to go out to bars.
Like, they live in Greenwich Village, for God's sakes.
Yeah. It's all they can afford to do.
Yeah, I mean, it is New York. It is expensive. But like, even like, you know, like, we, you know, Barry, we were poor young people in Toronto back in the day when we were roommates. And we still like, we didn't do that much. We did spend a lot of time in two separate apartments.
We did a fair bit.
Yeah, we also still went out. We still did things.
But you know why? Because Friends has this thing that a lot of sitcoms does, and Seinfeld has the same thing, is there is so very little drinking on it. It is a very chaste show in that regard, in that it wasn't until like way later, like How I Met Your Mother is
How
basically
I Met Your Mother. They're a bunch of
friends,
lushes. Yeah.
Is Friends, but they actually drink like real adults do. Yeah. So it was but on the other hand, they go to one bar all the time. So
yeah, they go to one bar all the time. But that to me is like more realistic than you know. Anyway.
No bar.
I think I remember when Friends came out, there was a big push of like, they didn't want them to go to a bar all the time because that was what was going on Cheers. So they had to be like, well, what's hip? And they're like, the coffee shop.
Big lattes. The 90s loved a big soup bowl-ass latte.
Yeah, it also didn't make any sense that Rachel was like, it was like a sit-down thing where Rachel was a waitress. Like, wouldn't that place just have baristas behind the counter? Like... Would there actually be people going around to the tables and serving them like that? Like, that doesn't seem, you know.
Not really.
She only selectively did it, too. Because most of the time, they just went right up to the counter to order.
Yeah. It would make way more sense if it were a bar and she were actually a server at the bar. You know? Anyway, that's enough.
Friends fans. We're coming for you.
We're coming for you. I guess we should move on to the spinoff. That's... you know, like I'll just start by saying like the shortest answer here is that this show, Ferris Bueller, despite being a failure, it didn't slow anybody down. Everybody in the main cast kept working after, like, it, you know, didn't put the brakes on anybody's career, at least at that time. So first we'll talk about Charlie Schlatter, Ferris Bueller himself. He's a super prolific voice actor. This is something we're seeing over and over again with a lot of these actors from 90s 80s and 90s sitcoms. Like, they might have had like one big role in one of these failed or forgotten sitcoms, but then they kind of like have a second act by doing like a kabillion different voice acting roles. So he, you know, some of his top credits include voices on a Sonic the Hedgehog cartoon, Bratz, the Bratz, you know, franchise. He's like a bunch of voices on that. He actually voiced the Flash on a few different series. He's currently on an Apple TV show called For All Mankind. It's like a space.
Oh, is he on that?
Yeah, he's on that one. Yeah, he's part of the ensemble of that.
He's got a good voice. I'll say that.
Yeah, he's got a lot of like announcery kind of narrator credits as well on his IMDb.
Anybody know who played Sonic the Hedgehog in all those shows?
No.
Jaleel White.
Oh my God, that's funny.
No way.
Nice.
Wow, that's wild. I want to like revisit that now. Okay, so next is Brandon Douglas, who played Cameron. So he had a few recurring roles on pretty iconic 90s shows, including 90210, Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman. He hasn't really done much after 2005. And it's one of those things where I've become very fascinated by this now. Now I like want to do a whole, not a whole nother segment, but I'm very like interested about these people who actually leave show business. Like, there are 1,000 reasons to leave show business. It's not an easy life for anyone, but like, I'm always so curious, like what they, you know, what they end up doing after. So I was like, I was kind of cyber stalking Brandon Douglas like earlier today, and I couldn't really find anything. So Brandon Douglas, if you're out there and you're listening, you know,
maybe you would have found something if you were a better hacker.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm not quite
he's living off the grid.
You know, I'm a pretty decent social media stalker, but like, yeah, I'm not quite the hacker that this Ferris Bueller was. Okay, so Amy Dolenz, who played Sloane in the Ferris Bueller sitcom, was, you know, actually the daughter of Mickey Dolenz. So Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. So that's kind of a fun trivia fact. She looks like nothing like him whatsoever. But yeah, she was in quite a bit of 80s teen movies and like leading up to this sitcom. Like, she was in was it Can't Buy Me Love with what's his name? McDreamy or whatever. So she's been in quite a few things in the 80s. She was also in quite a few, and this is kind of funny because going through everybody's IMDb, I saw a lot of people participating in other TWAS shows, so other shows that we've covered. She was in an episode of Teen Angel, and she was also in an episode of Saved by the Bell, The College Years, so that's kind of fun. Yeah, so I also cyber-stalked her a little bit too, and it looks like she moved to Canada, so... Amy Dolenz, if you are listening as well, you're not listening, but if you are, we want you on the podcast. We want to talk about your experiences on these failed or forgotten sitcoms. We also have one of the writers, Steve Pepin. He wrote for Get a Life. So there's like a lot of connections to other previous shows that we covered. Sam Fried, who played Bill Bueller, played a bunch of different characters on Law and Order. So it's that funny phenomenon we kind of touched on last episode where, you know, it's a known thing where you can like guest star on Law and Order a bunch of different times and play a bunch of different characters. So he has that in his background. Currently, you know, like he's done some interesting things in his like later in his career, including recurring roles on House of Cards, The Wire, and voices on Our Cartoon President. I already mentioned Christine Rose as having a recurring role on Friends, but she also guest starred on Davis Rules. So she also had recurring roles on Grace Under Fire, Ellen, Party of Five, Charmed. Like all the 90s kind of hits. And she also played Ted Mosby's mom on How I Met Your Mother. Yeah.
That's who it was. Yeah.
Yeah. So speaking of How I Met Your Mother, she was on there too. So she's played a lot of people's moms like in sitcoms. and then finally, we have Richard Reel, who we already touched on. So he is to me, one of the most recognizable character actors that like exists. Like, he's been in everything, and he actually has 413 IMDb credits. That might be like the most credits of anyone that we've ever like talked about. So he's got the record right now. And of course, like, my favorite role and the thing that I always remember him from is Office Space. He played Tom, and you know, with his jump to conclusions, Matt. Like, that's like the most iconic scene, in my opinion, of the
Tom 90s. Minkowski.
Yeah. His dream of dreams that he's able to realize when he gets his giant legal settlement is to create a jump to conclusions mat. And it's chef's kiss. Yeah, that's it.
But how did Jennifer Aniston do after this?
Oh, you know, she was in some other stuff. She kind of faded into obscurity.
Okay. Yeah. That's too bad. Should we check in with Mr. Producer and see if he has any insights?
Yeah, we can always call that guy. He usually has something to say.
Do we have to?
I kind of wish we didn't.
I don't want to subject Simone to this.
It's a fun routine now.
All right.
Yeah, can't wait.
Mr. Yeager, what can I do for you today?
Oh, hello, Mr. Producer. Well, today we're talking about Ferris Bueller.
Oh, sure. Great picture. Love it.
Oh, yes, it is. But we're actually talking about the sitcom based on the movie.
Oh, good God. Why?
Well, for our podcast, because we talk about sitcoms.
Podcast. Sure. You know, podcast about, you know.
Yeah, we do it about failed or forgotten sitcoms. So that's why we're talking about this.
Ah, yeah, God. That makes sense. You know, I was kind of struggling to figure out what connected all these random programs you were always asking me about.
Did you not know what our podcast was about?
Truth be told, no. But I felt like we'd been doing this a little too long to ask.
Well, did you have any connection to this particular show?
Unfortunately, I did.
Unfortunately?
Well, kid, some projects, they come from passion. Others come from money. Some come from favors. And sometimes, well, sometimes... A collection of North American PTA groups decide to put together a fund. And this fund, you see, it goes to producers. They put together projects that are, let's just say, safe for children. And might serve a bit of an alternative purpose.
Oh, like what?
Well, you see, the movie Ferris Bueller, that charming little bastard, he influenced a hell of a lot of kids. Suddenly, it was cool to skip school. It was cool to torment your principal. Cool to steal cars. Cool to play an impromptu lip-sync performances. It was goddamned chaos. So the parents, you see, they put together a project like this one with its own goal.
Which was?
Well, that was to make the Ferris Bueller character as unlikable as possible. So absolutely no teenager would ever want to emulate him.
Oh, well.
Mission accomplished, right?
Yeah.
This is not my finest moment.
Well, thank you for joining us and giving us that insight.
Always a pleasure, kid.
All right, you take care.
I mean, that's pretty dark that there was this whole conspiracy that, you know, informed this.
I wonder what else they were. Yeah. Jeez, what other shows?
Yeah, like what other shows, man, did they sand the edges off of? Did they like interfere or have a part in It's Your Move, do you think?
Definitely. Oh, for sure.
Definitely. Yeah, they definitely did. They must have came in. It's that whole lobby, the PTA lobby.
The PTA groups.
It's propaganda.
Yeah.
I guess we'll do the leftovers if anybody has anything that they would like to add from their notes.
So I don't know if you looked up any reviews of this, but I saw a newspaper clipping from when the show premiered, and it was the same week as Fresh Prince and the Uncle Buck spinoff on CBS. So this was an NBC show. So you had two different John Hughes spinoff sitcoms premiering at the same time on different networks.
Oh my God.
Wow. And it's both bizarre. Up against the Fresh Prince, which was a good show.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's funny because the reviewer was like, there could be something to this Fresh Prince. We'll see. Like, they weren't totally sold.
I don't know about this William Smith guy.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. My one last note that I didn't get to. So at one point I wrote down just, but how does he get the limo? And, you know, they do explain it sort of, but like,
oh, they explain it.
Yeah. He does favors for people and they owe him favors in return. So it seems like a lot of his character operates on that sort of basis of like, he's always doing hookups for people, making connections, fixing problems. He's like this powerful go-to fixer that not only all the other kids in school go to, apparently, but like random adults from out in like the world, like out in the city. So there's just like a whole host of people who owe him favors that he can call upon, and he like manipulates everything. But I guess my problem with that is like, there's no even like minor attempt to explain how he pulls that off. Like, from where does he derive these connections or this magical charisma that he's able to do this? And also I had a note about that like scene about that random kid who almost gets expelled just like by proxy. And it just felt like such a like a shoddily put together scene, because like Ferris Bueller himself seems to be like getting away with things constantly. And this one kid who like just sort of knows him, I guess, was going to get expelled for that, like to make an example out of him in that thing on the stage. Yeah. Weird.
Yeah, I wasn't paying attention to that scene nearly enough to care.
It seems
the nerdy kid.
Like, yeah, he comes
back. Screech. Yeah.
He comes back a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like they throw expulsions out like willy nilly in this world. Like,
but like Ferris Bueller had a remote control that made the stage break open and the principal fall through the floor.
Yeah, that is a violent
and
act.
He didn't get in trouble for that.
Yeah.
And he showed up late. So when was he setting this up? Like, you would need like, you know, a good hour to install it before the whole thing began.
He had a stage guy.
Probably, yeah, got him Billy Joel tickets or something.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I can't imagine adults, let alone teenagers, trusting this kid because he's clearly an undercover cop. Like,
Simone, like the reference to getting Billy Joel tickets, is that like you think he's like Damone from Fast Times? Like he's got like, you know, all the hookups to all the
I actually watched the episodes twice because they were so confusing. I'm like, surely I'm missing details.
Yeah.
So one thing I gleaned on my second viewing, because I was really confused where this fake lawyer came from. That he brings in to like negotiate him suspension.
Right. Yeah.
And like, and he's like, I'm not a real lawyer. I'm like, well, then who is this guy? And then he says, well, thanks for the Billy Joel tickets. Like, yeah, oh, like, I guess that's their loose connection.
Why couldn't he have been a lawyer? Like, it would have made more sense if he had done a favor for a lawyer. Why? Who is, I need it. By saying he wasn't a lawyer, I immediately needed to know more.
Yes.
Because who was he? Was he an actor? Was he like, come on.
Any other leftovers, Simone?
So also on the editorial side, so the editor of the pilot edited 4 episodes of the Uncle Buck spinoff as well.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Busy time.
He also did Seinfeld, The Wonder Years, like tons of stuff at the time. In demand. Yeah.
Wow.
Very interesting.
Speaking of the Church of Seinfeld, Simone, do you have a favorite episode, or would you like to pick any episode that you think is like a funny comparison as to something that like works so much better than this?
One episode I really loved as a kid was the one where Kramer's buttering himself up all the time. It's truly bizarre. Yeah.
The visual of Kramer as the turkey.
As the turkey.
Waving the wings, makes me giggle. Hey, buddy.
Yeah. Always makes me giggle.
That's funny. I know a lot of people who love that episode.
Yeah.
I think I latched onto it as a kid, and then it just stayed my favorite episode. And I think that was like the later seasons too, where it got a little bit like weirder.
Zany.
Which
I
appreciate.
That's season 9.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My favorite part of that episode is the very beginning with the mustaches.
Yeah.
And that banter of like, what is Holland? It's a country next to Belgium.
And who are the Dutch?
No, that's the Netherlands. George, Holland is the Netherlands. Then who are the Dutch?
Yeah.
A vacation from ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you say that we were doing these mustaches for again? A vacation from ourselves? That was a fun show to talk about. I don't know how much it was a show, but it was a fun thing to talk about.
Yeah.
More fun than watching the show. That's
for much more fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Characters are way more likable.
Simone, did you have anything to plug, or is there anything you can tell us about that you've been working on recently?
Yeah, so I just wrapped up on a show for Amazon Prime called The Lake, which is Amazon's first ever Canadian original scripted series.
Amazing.
And it's super funny. They haven't set the release date yet, but I've heard summer 2022, so stay tuned for that.
Awesome.
And, very cool.
Less so on the comedy side, I'm just wrapping up on a film right now called Float, although starring Andrea Bang of Kim's Convenience.
Awesome.
But nice, it's nice. A romantic drama, and she's fantastic in it. She's really solid actor. And yeah, that'll hopefully be coming out later this year as well.
Amazing.
Well, I'm excited to see both of those things. That sounds great. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us to chat.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was really fun.
Cut to credits. That Was a Show is created and hosted by Bryn Burney, Andrew Barry Helmer, and myself, Aaron Yeager. It's a production of Radio Gizmo in Toronto, Canada. Subscribe, rate, review, and share. Follow us on Instagram and tell your friends about it. That Was a Show?
Radio Gizmo.